This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM. This is Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. Welcome, welcome to the late Erev Shabbos show with me as your host as we plumb the depth of this week's Torah reading and hopefully learn things that may kind of give us inspiration and allow them to be shared at the Shabbos table. Thank you all for making time so close to Shabbos to join us and to be part of what's going on at this time as we really get ready for Shabbos Kodesh. As always, our program is brought to you as a Refu Shlema for many Chodim. We'll just list a few of them. Yonatan Adi ben Chaya Rochel, Nadav Boruch ben Shani Sarit, Binyamin ben Leah Pua, Edel Rachmiel ben Elka, Chaya Bas Elka, Chana Fega Bas Tzirul Rezel, Oshri Bas Tzipoira, Batsheva Bas Leah, Beseich Shor Choyle Yisrael, amongst all those who might need a bit of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Rachmanis, a bit of help, a bit of a bracha in their lives. May the zchus of us coming together at this very, very auspicious moment of the transition from weekday into Shabbos, may that be something that is so powerful and has such an effect for all those people, takale shel obi zeiche, to a refuah shalema, and bekarav mamish. This week's Pasha has a startling pasuk. V'ha'ish Moshe anav ma'id mikala adam asher al pnei adama. Now the man Moshe was exceedingly humble, more than any other person on the face of this earth. And the Torah actually describes Moshe Rabbeinu as the humblest of all men. This does not mean that he was, of course, unaware of his sort of unparalleled greatness, his extraordinary achievements, or his role as Klal Yisrael's quintessential Rebbe and leader. On the contrary, Moshe understood exactly who he was, yet his humility lay in how he sort of perceived the source of his greatness. He felt that he had been granted opportunities that no one else had received. Had others stood at Har Sinai? Had they learned Torah directly from Hashem? They too could have risen to his level of leadership. Chazal teach that the Torah was given on Har Sinai, the lowest of mountains. Why? To convey that Torah can be acquired only through humility. If so, we might ask, so why was it not given in a valley, which is even lower? And the Kotzker Rebbe explains, no, that a valley is not the true symbol of humility. Nothing is remarkable about being low when one is in fact low. True humility is represented by Har Sinai, a mountain. It possesses height, it possesses stature, it possesses prominence, yet it remains low and unassuming. Authentic humility is not the absence of greatness, but the presence of greatness tempered by self-effacement. It is to stand tall, yet at the same time to feel small. Right? This idea carries actually profound implications in education. Right? A debate is ongoing amongst educators. Should a child be raised with strong self-confidence, encouraged to feel great about himself, or should he be guided towards humility, to see himself in a more sort of diminished light? The Shem Yishmuel offers a balanced approach. In the early stages, a child must be uplifted, encouraged, and given a sense of worth. He must feel that he can achieve, that he matters, that he has the capability to be great. Only after he has achieved already a certain plateau of confidence can he be taught the refinement of humility. Without a sense of self, humility is not humility. It's actually insecurity. This is 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. This is the late Erev Shabbos show.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. A warm welcome to those who are just joining us. We are here to discuss a little bit about the weekly parsha and, of course, our Hilchos Shabbos slot towards the end. And we hope, as we're actually approaching Shabbos imminently, that we'll take something from our show, something that you might be able to inspire yourself, something that you might be able to discuss at the table. So I want to sort of stick to an area that maybe we don't necessarily talk about so much in this week's parsha. And those are the dramatic events that the Torah talks about after the two sort of watershed sukkim of Vayibin Soya, after the second backwards noon. So we have the whole parsha of what's called the Misonanim, the complainers, in chapter 11 from verse 1. And the Torah actually begins with a pasuk. Vayihi ha'am kimisonanim. The people were like complainers. Ra bozne Hashem. They were evil in the eyes of Hashem. Vayishma Hashem. And Hashem heard what they were saying. Vayicharapoy. And Hashem got angry. Vativar bom eish Hashem. And the fire of Hashem burnt amongst them. Vateichal biktzei hamachane. And it's consumed, either the edge of the camp or some of the greatest people of the camp were killed by this fire. Straight after that, we have another description. Safsuf asher bekirboy. Safsuf is like the riffraff amongst them. His avutava. They had a tremendous, tremendous desire for something. Vayoshuvu vayivku. And they sort of motivated, they convinced all of the Jewish nation to cry. And they said, "Mi yachilenu basa? Who's going to feed us meat? We were better off in Egypt. We even remember the fish that we used to eat there." And, even though from sort of the way these psukim are organized, it would have been possible to understand that we're talking about two separate events. The commentaries of the Torah explain all of it as one big sin, as it's possible to see from the words of Rashi and the Ramban. Now, if we look carefully at the psukim, it's possible to see that the anger of Hashem against the Jewish nation was sort of evident straight away at the very beginning of the story. It says really Hashem was angry straight away when the complainers began. Already it says that the anger of Hashem was kindled against them. Moshe Rabbeinu only got angry a little bit later. Moshe Rabbeinu got angry when he saw them crying in their family units, which is a little bit later, only in verse 10. And as the Sifri says, which Rashi quotes, and our rabbis say, what does it mean? They were crying in their families. They were crying about family matters. Why? But the forbidden marriages that had been proscribed to them at Matan Torah, family members, relatives, you're not allowed to marry. They were upset about that. And of course, this needs to be clarified, particularly that there certainly is a place to perhaps understand the pain and suffering of about that all these people who were their best friends, that were close to, were now precluded to them from marriage. And they almost had to, many of them, had to actually separate from their wives who were forbidden to them. And that's a very, very difficult thing. And maybe they were married for many, many years. So if so, why did Hashem get angry? And why was it so bad in the eyes of Moshe? And until now, he was quiet. Only then did he get angry. And the second big problem is, if we look further, and the way Hashem sort of solved this whole dilemma also needs quite a lot of thought. First of all, it says that the meat, which Hashem did give the Jewish nation for 30 days straight, so either way, this meat was not something that was going to satisfy all their complaints, because they were also worried about missing the fish and the melons and the zucchinis, all those things they were missing. So what, with all the things they were complaining about, what's it going to help to send meat, this quail meat? How is that going to quench, and how is that going to satisfy all of their desires? And in particular, that obviously there was no shortage of animals around. The Jewish nation had plenty of sheep and cattle, that they had absolutely no, in reality, they were not lacking meat at all. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu at the end throws up his hands and he says, I can't do this anymore. I can't carry this whole nation. It's too heavy for me. And therefore, Hashem says, fine, no problem. Hashem appoints him to appoint 70 elders that previously they had been the so-called kapos in Mitzrayim. And their great attribute was that they merited a sort of momentary or a temporary a prophecy, as it says in verse 25. The Spirit of God descended on them, and they prophesied once off, and Rashi says they only prophesied on that one day, with the exception of Eldad Umeidad, right? They merited to a prophecy that didn't stop, as in fact the Medrash tells us, right? They weren't actually merited to be included amongst the 70 Zekanim. And we need to understand what actually is going on over here altogether. So Rashi actually tells us that ein misoinim elaloshen alila. This concept of misoinim, complainers, is just people looking for a pretense. They're looking for something to complain about, how they could now sort of turn away from Hashem. And so it was with the whole issue of these complainers, as you see in Pasuk Daled, right? Rashi says, Eleshem Mavakshim Alila. They were looking for a pretense to rebel against Hashem. And the Ramban says a similar thing. The clear understanding of this Pasha is that the whole claim of these so-called complainers was only a pretense, was only a pretext. There was absolutely no connection between what they actually wanted internally in their hearts, between what they actually verbally said. In their hearts, they wanted to throw off from them the yoke of Torah and and of mitzvahs, and to sort of free themselves from Hashem. Their mouths, they claimed about meat and fish and zucchinis and melons and onions, etc., etc., right? And that was in spite of the fact that every single one of them had enough sheep and enough cattle, what they actually took out of Mitzrayim with them. And obviously the mun also, they had the mun, and they could taste any taste they wanted. So it comes out that these Mitzrayim themselves were just sort of mixed up, they were confused themselves in their own desires, right? That they actually they emanated from a desire to completely throw off HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore they spoke, right? And they just aired all their desires that they knew could never ever be realized, and they all cried on the fact that they weren't getting what they wanted, and about their forbidden relationships that were sort of forced upon them. We'll take a break now. I'm going to come back and try to make some sense out of all of this. This is 101.9 Chai FM. This is the late Erev Shabbos show. My name is Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. We are discussing the misoinonim, the complainers, people who we said are looking for an excuse to throw off the yoke of Hashem. And they complained about not having meat and not having fish. And we asked, so why did it take so long for that? Only when they were crying about the forbidden relationships, why did it take so long for Moshe to get angry? And the answer perhaps is that in the beginning, when they were complaining about not having meat and fish, so Moshe Rabbeinu didn't get angry because Moshe Rabbeinu thought that these kind of people, yes, they're real. They have a sort of a control problem, and they want more and more. They have an avarice kind of they want the taste of a steak between their lips, and they want the gourds, and they want the melons, and only HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who actually knew what was going on and could read minds and hearts, he knew that they were after something much, much deeper, and they actually wanted to throw off completely the yoke of Torah and Mitzvot. And that was sort of what was motivating their words. And that's why Hashem got angry right then and then. But when they began crying in that same sort of gathering, also on the laws of the Torah, on the forbidden relationships, in other words, that they compared the sort of the real pain that they had with them from having to perhaps divorce their own wives to the sort of minor problem of not having meat and not having melons to eat, when they were giving these two things the same sort of value, Moshe Rabbeinu understood that their whole argument is not real. It's a trumped up thing, and their one desire is to sort of not have to accept the yoke of the 613 mitzvahs or even part of them. And therefore it says straight away, while they were crying about the forbidden relationships, uveinei Moshe Ram. Now Moshe understood how terrible this whole thing actually was. And that's what Moshe said to Hashem. Me'ayin li bosa, where am I going to get meat to give this whole nation? Give kul alema, they're crying to me saying, Tina lanu basa v'nechela, give us meat and let us eat. Right? And obviously, you can't say that Moshe had any doubt about the ability of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to supply as much meat as would satisfy the entire Jewish nation. That was not a problem, as in fact the some of the commentaries raise. But Moshe Rabbeinu, once he understood the real root of their desire and their claims, he knew that all the meats in the entire world, anything could conjure up, was never going to silence those complainers. Because that really wasn't the problem. And it wasn't meat what was bothering them. The root of their problem was something entirely different. And therefore, even if they would get meat and they would use their sheep, right, they would want, you know, if they had sheep, they'd want the beef. And if they get beef, then suddenly they'd want fish, etc., etc. It was absolutely a void that could never be filled. And the more HaKadosh Baruch Hu would try to fulfill their desires, it wouldn't help at all. Because their complaints was not really what they were wanting, because in their hearts, deep down in their hearts, they were looking to completely free themselves from the yoke of Torah, and all of their claims were just a pretense. In this situation, Moshe said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "La'uchal anochi levadi, I can no longer do this myself. I can't carry this whole nation. Ki chaved mimeni. It's too heavy for me." In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu understood that in this situation, there's absolutely no chance to be able to lead and direct such a nation, where in their hearts, they're already out of it. They completely want, they have a disdain, they have a dislike, they want to distance themselves totally from the yoke of Hashem. And they don't want to be sort of controlled, they don't want to sort of be shackled by the dictates of the Torah. So therefore, is a major, major problem. And Hashem sort of divides up the solution into two sections. Firstly, we have to sort of remove the sort of stuff that they were saying. There's absolutely no room to leave even a possibility of anyone having a shadow of a doubt about the ability of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which of course is unlimited. And therefore, if the nation wanted meat in the desert, and they said, who could possibly feed us meat? Hashem had to prove to them that it was within the power of Hashem to feed them meat, even in the middle of a desert. And there's no sort of limitation at all in Hashem's ability. And therefore, Hashem poured down on them this quail, this love, for 30 days straight. However, in conjunction with this, the root of what they were saying also, you know, this was to deal with the surface problem. But the root of the problem also, which was their desire and disdain for Torah, that also needed to be fixed up. And what do we need to do? We have to bring the people back to a situation where they were actually forced to accept the leadership, the control, and the dominion of Moshe Rabbeinu, and their total subservience to the Torah of Hashem. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sort of joined to the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu these 70 Zakenim, that they should stand on Moshe's right side. Now, to do this, there wasn't actually a need to have people who are on an especially high level, right? Sort of people that were the greatest leaders in Torah, that they should sort of help Moshe Rabbeinu in handing over the tradition, because that wasn't their purpose. The purpose of appointing the 70 Zakenim was to elevate the entire nation, to bring them back to where they were, to speak to their hearts and bring them to a much better place. And for that purpose, It's there's nothing more fitting. There are no better people to be able to make the rounds and make that kind of a appeal to the Jewish nation than to use those Zakenim who were the kapos of the B'nai Yisrael for years and years of the enslavement in Egypt. And these are people who literally gave their bodies and were beaten up and were tortured. What for? Only for the purpose that the Egyptians should not actually hit and beat up the Jewish slaves themselves. They took the rap for all of the Jews for all of those years. Such a mysterious nefesh, such absolute dedication in Egypt for all of their brethren. That would stand in their stead now without any doubt. That when they would come to speak sort of emotionally and to try to bring the people back to their Father in heaven, right, that they should listen to their words, and they would listen to their words, because the people knew, and they were convinced that these men who were prepared to give their lives for the Jews, for sure, even now, when they were talking, they must have been talking for the benefit of the Jewish nation. These people didn't have a shred of false sort of duplicity in them. If they were coming and saying something, it was the absolute truth. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed his divine prophecy, his nevuah, to dwell on them in order that the people should realize also their spiritual greatness and willingly accept what they had to say. But even so, we need to address and think about why were these elders, why did they merit to specifically get prophecy only on that day? And their prophecy didn't continue beyond that one day. So, since we actually explained above that these Zakenim only merited Nevuah, not because necessarily they were the greatest, independently great people that sort of worked on themselves and rose from one level to another, you know, with the kind of a concerted effort that God demands from those people who actually deserve to be prophets, as in fact the Rambam describes in Perek Zayin of Yesod HaTorah, the incredible regimen that a person has to go through to actually merit to be a Navi of Hashem. But rather, their Nevuah was a gift from Hashem. It was a tremendous reward for their dedication, for their Mesirut Nefesh in Mitzrayim, for the sake of the Jewish nation. And as a means of awakening the hearts of the people to believe them and to listen to them. Therefore, their essence as Nevi'im wasn't really that they were actually Nevi'im, but they received Nevuah as a once-off gift for the purpose, for a particular purpose to influence the Jews to come back. And therefore, there was no need for that prophecy to continue beyond that one day. And in that way, also, we can see from the very, very essence of the Nevuah that was given to them. As in fact, the Medrash says that they prophesied about this slav, about the quail, that it was going to come for 30 days in a colossal amount, a prophecy that the whole point of it was only to bring this whole episode to a conclusion and to return the people back, to turn their hearts back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, either through the revelation of the incredible, unlimited ability of Hashem, or by bringing them sort of back to Hashem, as the Medrash in fact says. And in fact, the very type of Nevuah and the way the Nevuah was given to them was very, very different than the classic way Nevuah is transmitted. As in fact, the Pasuk says, Yoradati, Hashem says, I'm going to come down. V'dibati imchasham, and it says to Moshe, I'm going to speak with you there. V'atzalti minaruach ashalach, I'm going to pair off a little bit of the greatness that you have, the Samti Alem, and I'm going to give it to them. And that's what Chazal say in the Medrash, that their Nevuah wasn't from Hashem, it was actually from Moshe Rabbeinu. And it wasn't like any of the other prophets who merit prophecy from Hashem himself, because their whole purpose of all that prophecy was to sort of transfer and transmit the will of Hashem to the nation and to teach them Torah and Mitzvahs. And therefore, their Nevuah needed to be specifically in such a way, in an elevated way, and because we are with a certain amount of preparation. But here, for the purpose that Hashem needed them to be prophets, so it was sufficient that they themselves did not have to be on a very, very high level of Nevuah. And Nevuah didn't even have to come from God, it could come from Moshe himself. However, Eldad and Medad were an entirely different kettle of fish, because they merited Nevuah in a real sense. As in fact, the Medrash says, they received a Nevuah directly from Hashem. And they also merited that their prophecy wasn't just a once-off, it didn't stop. Why did they merit a real Nevuah that sort of was appropriate for their spiritual level, for their very high level? So that we can see in the tremendous, tremendous attributes of modesty, which they revealed when they were not chosen to serve with the other 70 Zekahim. They were left out, right? And that modesty, they didn't complain, they didn't have an issue, they didn't go wild. That became the source, that became the deep well that fostered their Nevuah and raised them to a very, very high level, right? Since they never ever came with any kind of a complaint to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and their emunah was never ever faulted, even for a minute. These tremendous, tremendous attributes are one of the things that actually bring a person to real Nevuah, as the Rambam says there in Yisrael Torah, that they are able then to merit, according to a way that was appropriate and fitting for them, that they should have this Nevuah. And the merits of that, they also actually merited to go together with Yeshua into Eretz Yisrael and to be the Nesiim, to be the princes of their tribes. As the Medrash brings, that Eldad is Elidad ben Kislon, as I mentioned, who was one of the tribes, one of the Nesiim of the tribes who helped divide up Eretz Yisrael. He was the tribe of the prince of the tribe of Binyamin in Eretz Yisrael. And Medad was Kimuel ben Shiftan, who was the Nasi of Ephraim, as we see, and that's what the Medrash brings. So again, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu, faced with this sort of terrible, terrible problem, had to handle it in two ways. He had to deal, on the one hand, with the stark and jarring desires of the Jewish nation, which weren't really desires. They were really just an attempt to have complaints against God, to be a rabble rousers, and get the Jews to run away and free themselves from the yoke of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yes, they may have been upset about the fact that some of them would also have to, in fact, leave their wives, because they had married family members. It's very comfortable, very nice to marry family members, but at Matan Torah, they learned that, unfortunately, some of those relationships were actually barred by Torah law. One's not allowed to marry sisters or aunts or various close relatives, and that upset them. And yes, but they didn't handle the upset in a positive way. They handled it by just sort of outpouring against Hashem. But it wasn't an act of rebellion. It was an act that was motivated by this crass kind of desire to just run away and be free, and therefore by Moshe Rabbeinu coming, and number one, first of all, whatever you want, you can't face Hashem. Whatever is possible, you can possibly want, Hashem will give it to you to prove that He is Kol Yachol, He is able to do anything, and therefore your arguments have absolutely no credence, no place to even take effect. But at the same time, by marshaling the power and the sort of the convincibility, which made up that word, of these people who the Jews trusted and who the Jews knew were absolutely out only for them, and they would come and talk sense to them and talk softly to them, and they had prophecy. They were clearly not only respected people, they were great people. The people listened and turned away from their mad, sort of unwarranted desires, and they came back. They came back to Hashem. This is 101.9. Achai FM. The program is the late Erev Shabbos show. My name is Rabbi Moshe Sturm. We'll be back in a moment with our Hilchos Shabbos slot.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late afternoon Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. A warm welcome to those of you who are joining us now as we literally approaching minutes almost from the onset of Shabbos Kodesh. What an amazing time of the week. We were sort of leaving behind us all the sort of the worries and the trials and difficulties of the week, and we're entering a different world. We're entering the world of Shabbos Kodesh, the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the world of absolute truth and peace and actual realism. As we always do at this point on the show, just to go through the important details and time, so to speak, that we need for this coming Shabbos. So, let's get started right away with the earliest time for lighting candles this afternoon. So it's not very far away. 4:17. 4:17 is already the time where we can start taking on Shabbos. And please God, if the food is ready and we've bathed and the house is set up, let's go for it. Let's light the candles early. Let us actually allow ourselves to be subsumed kind of by the atmosphere of Shabbos coming into our homes a little bit earlier even than it needs to. We kind of even begin to measure the incredible, incredible influence that's going to have on us, and not only on us, but on the entire world. You know, I was listening to someone recently, and they told the story about the great Rosh Yeshiva Rav Shach, who was walking with a student in Bnei Brak, where he lived, and they got to the outskirts of Bnei Brak and were about to enter the next town, which was Ramat Gan. And in Ramat Gan, there was traffic, there was busy, it was well, Bnei Brak, of course, there's a sanctity of Shabbos. And Rav Shach asked his student, he said, "And tell me, why do you think in Ramat Gan there are people sort of driving and not treating the Shabbos with respect?" So the student said, well, because they don't know, they have never learned halacha, they don't keep Shabbos. So Rav Shah said, that's not correct. The answer is, because we, those of us who are keeping Shabbos, aren't putting enough intensity, enough kedusha, enough purity, enough beauty into our Shabbos. If we truly, truly kept Shabbos in the most beautiful, perfect kind of way, the light, the holiness, the speciality of our Shabbos would spill over, and even the other people, even the people in the Matgan, could very, very well continue, perhaps start to keep Shabbos. It's all up to us. We the community that keeps Shabbos, we have to keep it a little bit better. We have to put more intensity into our Torah learning, into our beautiful time spent with with the family, into not wasting the holy minutes of Shabbos. So 4:17 as it comes, let's already grab it and try to take it with us and begin Shabbos as early as possible. If we can't manage 4:17, well, 4:30 is great. 4:45 is great. The latest time, in fact, for lighting Shabbos candles this Shabbos, this is the earliest it's going to get, is 5:05. 5:05 is the absolute latest. And yes, that's the moment we have to realize is our absolute deadline in accepting Shabbos. Yes, of course, there are the next 18 minutes until sunset. But as we always say, that is emergency time, that is injury time for those who, God forbid, otherwise might end up actually breaking Shabbos. So we give them that little bit of a buffer. But as far as we're concerned, 5:05 is the absolute deadline for us to have everything in place, everything all lined up and squared away for the coming of Shabbos. As I say, sunset is then at 5:23, and therefore, if you want to make sure that you can daven Ma'ariv already when it's properly night, and therefore fulfill the mitzvah of saying Krishma, all one has to do is wait until 5:41. 5:41 is already nighttime. It seems so early. But, you know, before we know it, it turns around and starts going the other way. And, of course, we come home from shul. We have a long, long night. It's a little bit chilly, but not too bad. And we have plenty of time to spend with the family and talk with the family and go over the week's events and speak about situations that happened where you saw the hand of Hashem and learn some Divrei Torah and sing a bit and eat some yummy food and just don't waste a night. Even when you finish the meal, you finish whatever, 8, 8:30, still not time to go to bed. So instead of just picking up a newspaper, pick up a sefer, pick up something worth reading. Sit with the kids and go through the parsha. There's so much to talk about on this week's parsha. Make it count. Make it something very, very special. Tomorrow, of course, we're going to learn Parshas Bahaleska. It's quite a long parsha. Lots and lots of very, very important events. And the beautiful Haftarah that goes with it, the Haftarah of Rani of the Simchi, and the vision of the Menorah and the redemption that is brought there. And of course, it's not a long Shabbos, but we're doing Pirkei Avos. We're doing Perek Beis this week, the second chapter of Pirkei Avos, and again, lots to learn. There are beautiful, beautiful lessons. Every Mishnah is in itself a whole tractate, is a whole masechta for us to learn and understand the ideas and the Musa and the teachings of Chazal. So it's a short day, but Shabbos Kodesh ends tomorrow night at 5:57, 3 minutes before 6, and then of course we go into another beautiful, beautiful week. We are busy with the Hilchos Shabbos. We are busy with the laws of agriculture, with planting, with harvesting, and what's called plowing and harvesting. And I want to talk a little bit about today about the concept of using trees on Shabbos. So we know that as a precaution, Chazal actually prohibited us from using a tree on Shabbos. Of course, out of the concern that one might end up either breaking off a branch or even a leaf off that tree, which we said is koitzer, is separating something from its source of growth, is a violation of a Torah prohibition. So therefore, Chazal didn't even want us using trees because of the danger of coming to that. Therefore, one is not allowed to climb a tree. One is not even allowed to lean against a tree, nor may a person actually place items on trees or remove items from the trees. Right? If the wind blows an item, let's say clothing, into a tree on Shabbos, one may not remove it. Similarly, one may not sort of recover, this happens so often, recover a ball that fell into a tree, and you can't even sort of shake the tree so that the ball is going to fall out. And that's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman 336 and Siman Shin Lamed Vav, and the Mishnah Berurah brings it there also. One should take care not to place things on a tree even before Shabbos if it's something that's going to be needed on Shabbos, says the Mishnah Berurah. However, one may touch a tree if he is not using or moving it, right? When we talk about muktzah, we talk about moving, but if you're just touching something, there's no prohibition. You can touch a tree as long as you don't actually move it. Not only is using a tree prohibited, it's also prohibited to use items that are resting directly on a tree. For example, one may not use a swing that is attached to a tree, even only one side is attached. One may not remove an item of clothing from a clothesline that is tied to a tree. Similarly, one may not climb a ladder that is resting against a tree, and one may not remove things from a sort of a basket that's hanging from a tree. Those are all considered situations where a person is actually using the tree. We're going to take a break and come back with some final comments. This is 101.9 Chai FM. The program is the late afternoon air of Shabbos show. My name is Rabbi Moshe Schnurb. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is the late Erev Shabbos show with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb on your radio as we spend the last few minutes together before literally scurrying off to get our last minute preparations ready for the very, very imminently upcoming Shabbos. We are talking about using trees on Shabbos. So let's say, we said you're not allowed to use anything that's attached to a tree. However, let's say if a peg was sort of driven into a tree and a swing was hung from the peg, one may use the swing. And that's because only the peg is considered resting on the tree, while the swing is resting on the peg. Since the swing is sort of two steps removed from the tree, this was not included in the rabbinical prohibition of using a tree. Similarly, one may sort of remove an item of clothing from a clothesline that is tied to a peg stuck into a tree, because again, the clothesline is two steps removed from the tree. If before Shabbos one rested a ladder against a peg embedded in the tree, one may climb the ladder on Shabbos because again, the ladder is two steps removed from the actual tree. If before Shabbos items were placed in a basket, hanging from a hook stuck in a tree, one may put items into or remove them from that basket on Shabbos. Because again, this too is two steps removed from the actual tree. However, on Shabbos, one may not rest the ladder against the peg or hang the basket on the hook, because that would be making use of an item resting directly on the tree. And that's the Shulchan Aruch says again in Shin Lamed Vav, and the Mishnah Berurah brings it. Then you're using directly the item itself. And regarding the sort of the roots of an old tree that sort of protrude above the ground, if they protrude less than 3 tefachim, let's call it 30 centimeters, from the ground, then they are considered equivalent to the ground itself, and one may sit upon them. However, if the roots protrude above the height of 3 tefachim, let's say somewhere between 24 and 30 centimeters, so then they are considered equivalent to the tree itself, and again, one may not sit upon them. Okay, our time is really up, and it's time to really run off and do our last minute preparations. I want to thank all of you for joining us and being part of our radio show, especially this late on a Friday afternoon. I really, really appreciate it. And just want to wish every single one of our radio family a beautiful Gebenst, a beautiful blessed Shabbos. Keep warm, keep inspired, and let's keep together. Our Achdus, our unity of all keeping Shabbos together, is the most powerful weapon we actually have. To one and all, a Shabbat Shalom, a good Shabbos.